Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. The day after Thanksgiving is the unofficial start of the holiday season. Though anyone who's been shopping lately knows the Christmas decor comes out during Halloween. But with the unofficial official start to the holiday season upon us, we here at All Sides wanted to share some ways to get into the spirit. And we begin with a historic mansion built by the co-founder of the Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company. It's Stan Hewitt Hall and Gardens in Akron. Jenny Highfield is the president and executive director of Stan Hewitt, and she joins us now. Jenny, welcome to All Sides.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
So construction of Stan Hewitt Estate started in Akron in 1912, and it was a private residence for a man named F.A. Siberling,
you had it right.
Siberling. He was the co-founder of the Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company. So how did it get the name Stan Hewitt? Why isn't it Siberling Hall?
That's a great question. So all great homes, they were from Europe, have proper names. And this family found inspiration from proper homes in New England, in Europe, and had many visits to Europe to determine the structure of this. And so their children, who were in college, talked to their college friends and kind of said, "Hey guys, what do you think would be a great name?" And Stan Hewitt means, it's Old English for stone quarry. And we are actually built on a stone quarry.
Ah, you always, when you hear Stan Hewitt, I think, the rich guy was Stan Hewitt.
Yes. We get calls for Stan all the time.
So it's Old English for stone quarry, and it's a Tudor style house, correct?
Correct. It is a Tudor style home that was built in 1912 to 1915. But if you visit the house, you really truly believe you're stepping back into the 15th to 18th century in Europe. It was very well built and quite lovely.
Today, it's one of the largest homes open to the public for touring. Just how big is it?
So our total property range is about 80 acres. We have 30 of that open to the public. The manor house proper, which is the largest historic structure on the estate, is about 64,000 square feet with 65 rooms.
Oh my goodness.
But then we have, it's quite large. And then we have other historic structures such as the Gate Lodge, which was the founding meeting for Alcoholics Anonymous, and our carriage house and other historic structures on property.
Yeah. How many bedrooms? Like, how many people could Stan Hewitt Estate sleep?
Well, if we sort of did like the sleepover method of today, I'm sure we could fit several, probably a few hundred people on the floor with sleeping bags. Properly today, there was intended for about 20 visitors at times. And we've had many visitors. The family had many visitors over their history.
Yeah, it's even got a ballroom.
Yes, we do. We do have a ballroom with a proper minstrel's balcony and stage for performances. The family loved performing arts. The woman of the house, Gertrude, was a very well-accomplished artist herself, a musician and painter.
They must have had some pretty amazing parties there.
They did. And the family loved Christmas. So the stories go that the children, in order to receive their presents at Christmas time, had to perform something. It could be anything, but had to perform something that could be reading a poem to performing a play or playing musical instruments or singing. So, yes, their parties were quite a fun event to attend.
Oh, my goodness. And you mentioned this briefly, the Gatehouse, which is a smaller house on the estate, is where Alcoholics Anonymous was created. And it's their daughter-in-law who brings the co-founders together to talk about their own drinking problems. It's wild.
That's absolutely right. And so Henrietta Siberling was part of a group called the Oxford Group. And the Oxford Group believe in this method that one could help themselves with through a higher power, not necessarily a religious higher power, but it could be, and had seen results with that. And and brought Dr. Bob and Bill W. together, and that was the beginning of Alcoholics Anonymous.
So when did the mansion convert from a private home to the public tour space that we have today?
In the mid-1950s, Mr. Siberling had passed, and the family was trying to make decisions on what do you do with this large estate. At that point was much more acreage of land and so forth, and made the decision that they wanted it to serve this community. That was always important to the family. Much of our community was built or created through the generosity of this family. And so they decided that the best thing for them to do was literally to turn the entire property and house and structures over to the community for everyone to be able to enjoy and see in the future. And so we are very fortunate. We have about 95% of all original contents for the house. So I just that they walked out and left the toothbrush and the toothpaste and left it for us to enjoy and interpret.
Yeah. Do you have any of the original like Christmas decor in the house?
No, we don't. We have lots of pictures and so forth, but which we then recreate. Some years we'll recreate those special Christmas images, but no, not the original decor. So this year in our house, we have one of Mr. Cyberling had a few tire companies, and one of his last tire companies, Cyberling, he had this really fantastic vintage ad of Santa with a tire, and that's on display this year in the Manor House.
Oh, that's cool. Let's talk about the tour, because Stan Hewitt does events and weddings, but during the holiday season, y'all really go all out.
We try to. So what better place when you have a 65-room mansion to, and Christmas was such a really important part of that, to really celebrate the holiday season. And so we decorate the rooms. We have designers from the region come to decorate. Our own staff and volunteers step forward and decorate all the rooms and different themes for the holiday season. And then there are almost 2 million lights across the estate, so that you can visit the grounds and walk outside and see our conservatory as well, which has a big, beautiful poinsettia tree, kindred to your Franklin Park Conservatory, so that our estate really truly transforms into a magical winter wonderland.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, a lot of the lights are outside. It's sort of like a zoo lights, but like that kind of, or conservatory lights. And then in the inside, it's all decked out for Christmas. Now, do you change the themes every year? How do you decide how you're going to decorate?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we do change the themes. We would love to, it would probably be easier if we just did the same thing, but because we have so many visitors who make this a part of their annual holiday tradition, we really feel like we want to make some changes every year to really keep them excited about what's coming up next year. Some things are tried and true. We have Northeast Ohio Lego Users Group, who creates a Lego room every year, but it's a different theme every single year of what the Legos are, but they create an entire room of Lego displays. But each year we get to transform the spaces into really unique interpretations of Christmas decor.
Do you have a favorite one this year, like a must see if we're coming out this season?
You know, I can't answer that. That would be so unfair. No, I would say there are a couple. There's a Muppet Christmas room, which I know people are going to really have a lot of really fond memories from their own childhoods to share. There is an organic farmer who did two rooms that are very natural, but one is our library, which is a really special, rich, vibrant room. And he took books and made all of these ornaments out of books. And that room is quite spectacular. I think everybody's going to find something. There's floral trees and so forth and so on that really harkens to the natural side of our estate. So I think somebody will find something in there to really enjoy.
I did the tour many years ago before I had kids. And one of the things that really fascinated me was the Victorian hair wreaths. It's such a strange quirk, and you're looking at it and you're like, wow, that's really intricate. And also, what?
Yes. I think there's a few things in the manor house, right? That I think, you know, if you can see them while you're here. Now, deck the hall, we change a lot, so you don't get to see sort of the entire historic estate and all of its glory. But, you know, there are a few really interesting objects and so forth that the family have in the house. It was a very modern house when it was built, but built to look like it's very old. So, yeah, there's interesting instruments, all sorts of fun things there.
What do you think the family would make, or Mr. Cyberling would make, of how the house is being used today?
Oh, it's such a great question. You know, actually, the family still vibrantly living in the community. They live all over the United States, and they do visit us, and some work for us. Actually, we have some family members here. So They really enjoy it. Again, because the holiday season was a time of the family being able to come together because they too lived all over. And it was a time to really bring the family back together and visit and share. They were a very close family. And so I think the family really appreciates the opportunity that we offer for all of you to come with your family or your friends and truly share in this really magical holiday experience and make memories. We hear that a lot, that it's a place to make memories. And I think that's what the family really wanted for the estate, was to continue that tradition of being able to come together, share and remember and make memories.
Our board operator says the drawings with the crayon on the wall in the kids' bedrooms is one of his favorite. And that's definitely like you think this big fancy estate, and they were cool with the kids having drawn on the wall.
And left it, right? Like we would all go back and color paint over it or whatever and so forth. No, they celebrated it, they left it, they're still there today.
Yeah, I think the crest bearing the motto above the manor house entryway seems to really encapsulate what the house was about. And I'm not going to try the Latin, but I guess the translation is not for us alone.
Yes, non nobis solum. And
Thank
that
you.
truly is our mission, right? We really believe this estate is for everyone. Whether you're coming here because you love history or arts and culture or environmental, or because you're coming here on a pilgrimage to visit, some spaces for the birthplace of Alcoholics Anonymous, we know this is a place that really is truly meant for everyone.
So let's talk about some of the practical things. If you want to go check out Stan Hewitt during Christmas, probably should buy tickets in advance. I think it gets pretty popular.
Yeah, so we always tell people to plan ahead to buy your tickets. You can go to stanhewitt.org to purchase your tickets. You will want to plan ahead because as we get closer to the holiday season and to the end of December, we can sell out. It's very common for us to sell out our nights. Please plan to get your tickets. There are plenty of really fun attractions and wonderful places to eat in the region. So there's plenty for you to do when you stop up here in Akron.
One of the things that I remember is that you park a pretty decent, like ways away, and then there's like shuttle buses. I don't know if that's still the case, but it's something to keep in mind that like how you're going to get to the house itself.
Yeah, so we do park. We have several lots on our property. And so, depending on what time you get here and how busy we are, you may end up parking in one of our alternative on-site lots. And so, yes, we will shuttle you straight up, no worries. We get you there. We also make accommodations, obviously, for handicap parking and so forth closer as best that we can. But yes, I would plan ahead. I always say to family, give yourself a solid 15 minutes to get here, get settled. So that you can truly, get your hot cocoa or hot apple cider and gingerbread cookie and enjoy the estate.
About how long does it take to get through the entire estate?
If you truly enjoy everything, for most people, it's a little over an hour. If you really enjoy all the outside, the conservatory and the manor house, though there are sometimes when I see someone and I think, didn't I just see you walk through admissions and you're already done? Some will come and just see the house and leave. So, but I usually tell people to plan for a little over an hour.
That makes sense. And I have to wonder because it's so incredible being inside of it. Like just having seen it, I'm like, it feels very romantic and like Great Gatsby-esque.
Yes.
But
Yes, it does.
I wonder, do people ever, are there proposals during the holiday season?
Yes, there are. And so many of us walk, we're working and walking the grounds. It's very common for us to happen upon proposals. Though a lot of times people will contact us ahead of time and say, I'm planning this because they really want to make it really special. Sometimes they want even a private space to do it in when there's not 2,500 other people standing around watching. But yes, and what a great backdrop for that and beautiful images to be able to take to get engaged here. And then we hope they come back and get married
I was going to
here.
say, you can get married there too. We do have a question about older people or those with mobility issues because how can they move around the house? Are there places where they won't be able to go?
Yeah, so the manor house is only accessible first floor only. But you still get to see the majority of the decorated rooms from the first floor. On normal tour days, not during Deck the Hall, we do have the opportunity for people to be able to use tablets to be able to see the second floor, and actually it would not decorate for holidays, but just what it looks like and so forth. But the rest of the estate, we make it so that they can move around. We do always warn everyone, though, it is just like if you go to the zoo or something else, it is outdoors, so you will be traversing on pathways and so forth. I think people sometimes think it's just drop me off at the front door of the house and pick me up there, but you will have to walk around the estate.
Especially if you want to see the outdoor lights.
Exactly. And we hope you do. And it's really magical to be able to see the gardens lit in such a special way.
How long, I got to ask, when do you start decorating? Like, how long does it take to hang 2 million lights and put up all these trees and decor?
Well, so the outdoor lights, we start sometimes as early as the end of September.
Oh, wow.
Yes, because we, you know, some of those trees, we're talking 30, 40 feet that we have to get up in the air with lifts and so forth to put lights up. And then the volunteers, really the bulk of it is done mid-October to mid-November, and to get it that done. The indoor spaces actually, ironically enough, go pretty quickly. So everybody kind of comes in and decorates their spaces all at once inside the manor house. And that tends to take about 2 weeks or less.
Oh, that's not bad.
Mm-mm, no.
How do you get on the list to decorate? I'm not suggesting that I want to be, but I'm just curious how you choose, like, who gets to do a room.
We do cards, and whoever draws. No, I'm just kidding. No. For the lifts, most of it's our horticultural and facility staff, though there are other people who've been up in our lifts and are trained to go up there and can do that decorating. In the manor house, we have trees as high as 16 feet. And so even there, we have to be a little careful. Those trees to get decorated and put up, we have to be a little cautionary with that. You know, and so forth. But we have a lot of volunteers and designers who step forward who really want to participate and share their passion for the holiday season. And so we knock on wood, have yet to have challenge of getting anyone who wants to decorate. It's usually making sure we have enough spaces for people to decorate.
Well, that's great. That was Jenny Highfield, President and Executive Director of Stan Hewitt Hall and Gardens. Real quick, how long are the lights going to be up?
So Friday after Thanksgiving, November 29th through December 30th.
And you can get your tickets at stanhewitt.com?
Stanhewitt.org, yes,
.org.
Absolutely.
Yes, yep. It's a nonprofit.
Okay.
Thanks so much, Jenny.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're previewing the Holiday Light Show at Columbus Zoo and learning what it takes to put it up. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're getting into the holiday spirit this hour with three different ways you can celebrate the season. Now, many of our listeners are probably familiar with the Columbus Zoo and Aquarium's wild lights, but we thought it would be fun to get a behind-the-scenes look. We're joined now by Donovan Harkness, the ground maintenance manager for the Columbus Zoo and Aquarium. Donovan, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Thanks. So we're all familiar with wild lights, or if you have children, you're probably familiar with it, but what it is such an incredible number of lights and displays that are strung every which way. So I guess my first question is, how many lights are we talking?
Depending on the year and the construction, up to 3 million.
Oh my gosh. Do you have to check each little bulb yourself?
Not each little bulb, but we do check every single strand at the end of each season to make sure it's working.
Oh my goodness. Where do you store 3 million Christmas lights?
That's a good question. We actually store them in different facilities all over the zoo, depending on what size.
Mm.
So probably about six different warehouse kind of structures that they're stored in.
I just imagine that scene from Christmas Vacation when Clark Griswold pulls out like the ball of tangled Christmas lights. I imagine you're much more methodical than that.
Generally, yes, but no, yes, that does happen.
Oh my goodness. So you have lights on the trees, on the water, you have giant snowmen. How do you decide like what you're doing year to year?
It's a team effort between the facilities department and the marketing department, because we want to change things up every year. A lot of the decisions go to color schemes around the park, so it's not the same as you walk through every year.
And you've been doing this, you said, for 30 years you've been putting up lights at the zoo?
Yes, I've been at the zoo for 30 years. My first couple years, I was helping with wild lights, and then as I became full-time, so almost 28 years actually helping install the lights.
How has it changed and grown?
It's changed a lot. The zoo's grown in the last 30 years. And so therefore, the light show had to grow with it, because as we became more popular and more visitors were coming, we needed more space for all the visitors. So as we opened up new regions, we would decorate all the new regions as we went through. Also, with LED lights now compared to incandescent when I started, gives us a lot more opportunities for decorating. And also with technology now, we use computers for the animated light shows throughout the zoo.
I imagine that's been really transformative.
It's a big difference. It goes from having just a static light show that you walk through to an interactive light show that's just an experience that's all around you and even above you.
Yeah, with some of the big trees, you can see them like change colors as they go out to the branches and like up and down and almost like they're swaying and like all these kinds of really neat visual optics.
Yeah, it's a lot of planning, of course. And we do that mainly by being able to decorate all the trees with multiple colors and then be able to turn them on and off depending on what color we want at a certain moment in time.
Do you have a favorite part of wild lights, a favorite display to put up every year?
Favorite? Oh, I have lots of favorites. Jingle Jam is one of my, I helped in the creation of that a lot. So it's probably my favorite.
Can you describe it for folks?
Jingle Jam is a display of 42 orbs that are suspended above our Shores Park playground. Every one of those orbs can change colors and blink on and off whatever color you want, and it is designed to go along with music for the animation. And we have 8 different short songs that play, so every song's different. And it's really cool because the playground is underneath it, so all the kids are playing on the playground while running around chasing the orbs as they change colors.
Oh, that's really neat. That's going to be so much fun to watch the kids like run through it.
That's one of the best parts about wild lights is just how happy all the kids are and just families in general.
Yeah. So wild lights opened last Friday and it runs through January 5th.
Yes.
And it is another one of those, if you want tickets, you should probably buy them in advance.
Yes. I definitely go on the zoo's website, columbuszoo.org, and that would be your best.
So when do you start getting ready? Because 3 million Christmas lights is a massive endeavor to install.
We actually start getting ready as soon as we have all the lights down from the previous year. That's when we need to start planning out everything, building new displays, getting all the colors ready to go for where we're putting them. And then we will actually start installing them at the end of August.
Oh, my goodness.
And then, as you stated, we also have other seasonal events that we have to work around, and we'll
put Boo at the Zoo.
Boo at the Zoo, yes, that's a big one because every weekend for Boo is very busy. And then we also we're actually still putting some lights up now, even though we've been open for a week.
So if you've already gone, you can come back and see something new.
Yes.
You also have Santa, but the line to see him can be very, very long.
Yes. Santa's very popular, especially on the weekends.
Yeah. And there are reindeer, and you can see some of the animals. They are out and about, depending on which ones they are.
Yes, and so many of our indoor exhibits are open during wild lights.
Is there any consideration for the animals? Like, how do you, like, do you work with the staff who, like, takes care of them?
Yes, all the keeper staff are involved in the planning of wild lights to make sure that it won't bother any of the animals.
What are some of the accommodations you guys have to make? Because I feel like the lights are everywhere, but I'm sure they're strategically placed.
They are strategically placed, and just the time period that we have them on.
Mm.
And also, I believe the sound in some areas is a little less than others.
Oh, that's really neat. Does anything change about your process year to year? Or do you guys kind of have it down pat at this point?
Most of it stays the same, except for anything new that we're putting in. Because anytime you put anything new in, it's going to have its challenges. But we mainly because of all the horticulture at the zoo.
Yeah,
that's where how we have to go around that. So it's all about how long the leaves are on all the bushes and the trees.
And if they change the landscaping, that changes the design.
Yeah, so we prefer to put the lights on without the leaves on the trees.
That makes sense.
Because when the leaves fall off, the lights will have to tighten them up a little bit.
That makes sense. Yeah. And it depends on the tree. My oak tree out front is hanging on to its leaves for dear life.
Yes, we actually have a lot of trees with leaves still on them. And when you decorate them with leaves on them, you don't see the lights as well. So we don't really get the effect that we're going for.
And that really varies season to season. What is new this year? What are some of the new displays that maybe weren't there before?
Oh, well, this is the first year that we have lights at the Dino Boat Ride Island. That's all brand new. All that area is decorated. The dinosaurs are all lit up. And so it's never done that before. We have added a new light tunnel to guide people through the North America Trek construction site.
Oh.
It is over 200 feet long.
Wow.
16 feet wide by 12 feet high, and it has 27,000 lights on it.
That's a lot of lights.
Yes, and it's a really cool opportunity for pictures, and that's a brand new. And then also our Jingle Jam exhibit, we went ahead and upgraded the orbs this year to RGB orbs, which gives us 5 colors per orb, and it's just new technology, and it really has upgraded that.
Oh, that's really neat. So the tunnel is to work people around the construction. So it's really out of necessity. But
yes.
But at 200, I assume the colors oscillate and change within the tunnel.
Yes, we have winter white on one part of it, which transforms into blue and then transforms into a twinkling white light above. And we also have LED snowflakes at the entrance. So it has a real big boom when you're walking up towards it.
Oh, my goodness. So you took something out of necessity, and it sounds like you made something that people are going to want every year.
Yes, we're very excited about this addition because we can utilize it moving forward at any spot in the park because it is modular.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. I expect there's, like, traffic jams just trying to get photos inside.
That is a worry because a lot of people want to get their pictures right there. But with it being 16 feet wide, it gives pretty good opportunity.
Yeah, I would think. What have you know, I wonder, as somebody who puts up 3 million Christmas lights a year, do you have any advice for those of us going to put up our own lights now?
I think the first advice that any of my staff would give anybody is when you put the lights, if you're putting it on a tree, on a bush, even inside your house, make sure they're turned on because then you know that they're operating because they are, as we all know, lights are known to go out while you're putting them up.
Well, that's a really good tip. How do you get it like snug around the tree?
One of our tricks is we wrap all of our lights when we store them light to light, and it's in a tight bundle, which you can then just hold in one hand.
Oh.
And then you can slowly let the lights out to keep them non-tangled
taut.
And nice and tight around.
Oh, it's in the storage.
Yes.
And,
and that also, if we are, maybe we're up in a lift and we need the lights to fall down. We don't want them to get tangled up. So if they're wrapped in the proper way, they will fall perfectly straight down and not
what?
Tangle.
Mm-hmm. So you're going to have to later, you're going to have to like sit down with me and explain how this works so I can, because we have a 2-story house and we are like, and how you can drop it down without it tangling sounds amazing.
Yeah, we can, we have some trees that have maybe 8 strands all strung together and they'll go all the way down to the bottom without tangling.
You guys should make like an Instagram video of it. Like everybody is probably listening is like, oh my goodness, I want to know how to do this with my lights. How many people are there for setup and takedown?
It varies. A lot of different departments that help anywhere from all facilities, marketing, operations. So I wouldn't be able to give the total number. On my staff, I would have, on any given day, it could be 8 to 25 per day.
Just putting, like working around the clock, putting up the lights.
Yes.
Oh my goodness.
And also we do run 3 shifts. So we have people there 24 hours a day, which helps because then we can also see what they look like. We can put them up in the day and think it looks great, but once you see it at night,
that's a really good point. It's like quality control.
Yeah, so we have three different shifts.
Yeah, I've definitely done that, like, with my husband. He'll be up putting them up, and I'm, like, you know, down on the ground being like, maybe you want to
do that. Yeah, I've had many things that we thought were going to be, you know, this is going to be great, and then we get to see it. We're like, we're going to have to change that around a little bit.
Yeah. I wonder, how does the process of developing a new design work? I assume that starts well before the season.
Yeah, besides the colors, we also try to build new light displays, like maybe some different animals, maybe different signage. And I have some very talented people on my staff, and they actually sketch these out by hand.
Oh, wow.
And then we're able to project them onto the size that we want. We actually just project it on very large sheets of papers. And then we have some excellent fabricators at the zoo, and they actually cut all of the steel, bend it all, weld it, and then we actually then put the lights on it. So it's a process. It takes a long time.
Oh, wow.
But most of our light displays, all the animal displays, we built in-house.
My board operator says there's a proposal sign with a secret switch. What is that?
Yes, through our marketing department, we do have a Will You Marry Me sign. And then off to the side, there's a little post with the switch on it. And if somebody wants to, if they contact marketing, they can, you know, get over. It's kind of a little out of the way, and then hit the switch and it lights up. Will you marry me?
So how do they get a hold of somebody if someone's looking to propose this holiday season?
That would also be on the website, columbuszoo.org.
I like that it's out of the way, so you're not surrounded by necessarily surrounded by like thousands of people.
Yes, it's out of the way enough, but yes, people will know that, see the sign line up.
Oh, that's so cool, though. It's very cute. I assume you guys get a couple of takers each season?
Yes, it's very popular, I think, just because it's a tradition to come to the wild lights every year. So,
yeah. Also, like, how often do you get somebody else setting up the lights for your proposal? Professional grade lights for this proposal. I mean, it probably makes for some amazing photos.
Yes. I think even without the sign, I'd assume people are still proposing at their favorite spots in the zoo.
Is there any section that's the most difficult or complicated to put together?
Probably our animated lake show.
That's really cool.
I mean, I think we're over 80 computers that we actually have to link together to make that work. So, I mean, we could easily have like a half a mile of Cat 5 data cable that we connect all these with. And then you start power and the lights, and it becomes a very complicated thing
so
to get
done. So
you
have like a whole like network of computers running this?
Yes, the animated shows. Yeah. Which we have one, two, three, we have four now.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, sometimes you don't think about the computing and processing power that goes behind this.
Yeah, it's definitely a challenge since it's all outdoors.
Yeah.
Even everything that's on our lake, we have to run underwater out to the different barges and then keep all that.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I mean, lights on water is complicated probably in itself.
Yes. Water, electricity and water and lights don't always go together that well.
But it looks so pretty when it's done.
Yeah, we're very lucky to have a main lake right there at the entrance to the zoo because it just gives us the opportunity for that.
Yeah. That was Donovan Harkness, ground maintenance manager for the Columbus Zoo and Aquarium. Wild Lights is going on now through January 5th, correct?
Correct.
And one more time, where do we go to get tickets and?
ColumbusZoo.org, the zoo's website.
Thanks so much, Donovan. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And I'm going to get that light tip from you here in just a second. Coming up, we're doing Seasons Eating on a Cincinnati Streetcar. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're sharing holiday events from across Ohio this hour. And from honey-baked hams to brightly decorated cookies, one of the biggest highlights of the season is always the food. From office parties to family get-togethers, food and drink are plentiful, and I'm told that calories do not count. Residents and visitors of the Queen City can enjoy this season on the Cincinnati Christmas Streetcar Food Tour. We're joined now by Laura Noyes, owner and tour guide for the Riverside Food Tours in Cincinnati and Covington, Kentucky. Welcome to All Sides, Laura.
Hello, Anna. Thank you for having me.
So tell me about the Cincinnati Streetcar Tour, because I know you guys used to have real streetcars running around.
Yeah. Well, we can get into that later. That's back in the 1890s.
Yeah. But
the Christmas Streetcar Tour operates between Thanksgiving and Christmas on Saturdays and Sundays. So it's a 3-hour adventure, and we're going all through town, gliding around on the streetcar and walking, visiting 6 different restaurants. And the theme that sets this one apart is because it's a Christmas around the world.
Oh.
So the food tastings and the restaurants that we go to represent traditions from Scotland or France and Belgium. And we tell you the stories of how other countries celebrate Christmas.
Oh, I love that. So it's 3 hours of walking and eating and riding and like learning about cultural dishes for the holiday season.
Yeah, it's pretty much a progressive meal. You're full at the end, and you're full of a lot of information and all kinds of things to do in Cincinnati, whether it's during the holidays or year round.
I have to imagine this kind of thing sells out pretty quick.
Yeah, well, you know, there's probably over 100 tickets available, and we're about 70% full. But, you know, Christmas is so busy, and I always say, if you can't make it at Christmas time, come anytime. We're doing tours 7 days a week.
And now, are there food tours year-round, too?
Yeah. We have 10 different themed tours, and we offer them, as I said, 7 days a week. And so there are various restaurants. Cincinnati's very fortunate to have so many local restaurants. So it's easy to do different theme tours throughout the city. And we also cross the river over to Covington, Kentucky, too.
Is there an age requirement to go? Like, would it be okay to bring a teenage kid?
Sure. There's 2 tours. There's a cocktail tour and a wine and dine and over the Rhine tour. So, of course, you have to be 21 and over. But all the tours are children-friendly. And if you have children 5 and under, they go free.
Oh.
You just share your food with them or bring a toddler snack or something. So it is a really fun family outing. And, you know, it really appeals to all ages. And we have a lot of families that this is their Christmas tradition. We've been doing this for 5 years. And it appeals to them because even though it's basically the same tour, it's just so stress-free. You just show up on Fountain Square and you get caught up in the razzle-dazzle of Christmas. You don't have to think. You're on a guided tour. And it just brings everyone together.
How do you decide the theme for the Christmas tour? So this what year is around the world? What's it been in some of the past tours?
Well, really, we stick with this.
Oh.
And that's what's so crazy is people never get tired of it. Sometimes we'll vary the restaurants a little bit, but this Christmas tour is pretty consistent year after year after year. But like, let's say, for instance, you go on the Ethnic Eats tour and over the Rhine, or you go on the Cincy Top 10 tour, or you go on the Finley Market Brunch tour. Those are all different from each other. So we have a lot of repeat guests because they just do all the tours because they like to try different restaurants.
I think it's going to be such a fun way to try out different places too. And you might get introduced to food or dishes or things like, even if it's a restaurant you've been to, it might be something you've never actually ordered.
Oh, that's such a good point. I always kid, food tours are like speed dating for foodies because you're going to knock out 6 places.
Yeah, and you get to preview them all and get a sense of what you might like or don't like. How do you work with folks who might have food allergies? Like, what should I know before I go?
We do, well, we have a specific vegan tour because sometimes vegans are the most difficult to deal with just because it's very restrictive. With food allergies, as long as we know ahead of time, we will try our best to accommodate those with food allergies and diet restrictions.
That's great. And should we dress for the weather? Like, I
Of
mean,
course.
yeah. Well, I just mean, like,
Yeah,
because
you
you're
know
gonna do,
what?
you said
And
there's some walking and stuff involved.
right. So there are tours that have more walking than others. We have a morning Cincy Top 10 sites tour, Sights and Bites. It's the top 10 sites in Cincinnati and the top five foods Cincinnati's known for. That's one of the biggest selling tours. And that tour, we cover a lot of ground from the Ohio River all the way up to Findlay Market. And even though we ride the streetcar, there's about 45 minutes of walking over the course of 3 hours. But man, that's a popular tour because you come to a city and you don't know what to see first. You don't want to go to chain restaurants. You want to enjoy the culture through food and you're learning so much. So food tours have really exploded in popularity.
I'm going to ask you a very difficult question. Do you have a favorite dish on the Christmas tour?
Allie, yeah. I like the Grater's peppermint ice cream because
Oh,
I
that's a
have a
good
sweet
one.
tooth.
And it peppermint ice
And
cream only comes out for this season.
And Grater's is a German started by Louis Grater in the 1870, who was of German descent. So Cincinnati, like all cities, are such an ethnic melting pot, you know,
Yeah.
so it's pretty easy to represent countries from around the world.
Yeah, I won't rope you into a Graters versus Jennies debate.
You know what? There is a location for Jenny's ice cream and over the Rhine.
Yeah,
Yeah,
we've got
so
Graters up
yeah.
here too. I think they're both good.
You're
You
right,
can enjoy
yeah.
both for sure.
That's for sure. Yeah.
It sounds like there's a lot of food that gets consumed. So safe to say, skip dinner, come hungry.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, we reach out to all our guests by text before we even meet them. And we tell them to come hungry. We tell them what to expect. And it's kind of nice that personal text because a lot of times guests will respond, "Oh, I'm so excited," or "We're celebrating our birthday," or they have questions in that. So by the time we do meet in person, we both feel like we know each other. So that's another important component.
What made you want to get into the food tour business anyway?
Well, that's a good question. To be honest, back in 2015, I had never even heard of a food tour. And we went on vacation to Newport, Rhode Island, a family
Oh, that's a
vacation.
beautiful
And
area.
I was Googling things to do, and I saw this Rhode Island Red Food and Culture Tour. And so saw the sightseeing, but it was food stops in between. And that appealed to me more than the sightseeing tour. So I signed the whole family up and I was so impressed. I was impressed with what I learned and the restaurants we got to visit, the amount of food. And I said to my husband, who had just recently retired from Procter & Gamble, "Well, this could be a second act. We could start a food tour in Cincinnati." And it's just exploded from there in the last 8 years. So I love doing it.
I love that he was on board with it. That's great. That you're like, I
Well,
think we should, our retirement plan is to start a food tour business.
yeah, and it was going to be one little tour in Mansfield Village in Covington, Kentucky, and now it's 10 tours. So, but you know what? There's so much to see and do in Cincinnati, and it's really turned into a destination city. So, you know, people love food tours. What more can I say?
No, and I can tell like your enthusiasm for it's infectious. It sounds like you really love all the tours that you do.
I do. And even though we have a team of 10 guides, I still enjoy getting out there and meeting people. We meet people from all over the world, from Europe, from, you know, South America, all of parts of the United States, from Canada. And I learn as much from them as I think they do from me. So it's a really culturally enriching experience.
How do you develop the relationships with the restaurants?
That's a great question. At the beginning, it was hard because we didn't have any brand recognition and they didn't understand the concept. You know, the question would be, why are people paying you when they can just walk into our restaurants? And I say, well, because this is a food tour and they're going to be learning a lot more. And so now it's pretty easy to get restaurants on board because it's great advertising for restaurants. You know, there are some restaurants like Nicholson Scottish Pub. They've been a partner with us for 8 years. And I did the math. We've brought in over 3,000 people through their doors. So it's free advertising. And we're paying for the food just like if you walked in, Anna. So it's not like they're giving us free food or anything. And it's just such a perk to have that exposure.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there's probably restaurants you've wanted to try. And it's just like you keep putting it off. You don't have time. Once you go in, you're like, oh my gosh, this is so cool. Why haven't I been here before? And if you love it, what do? You go home and you tell all your friends, you got to try this restaurant.
Yeah. I think word of mouth advertising is so persuasive just because we trust the people that we know and we love and we like take their taste into consideration.
Yeah. And you know, that's why we love reviews. Right?
Oh, yeah.
Because I can sit here all day and tell you how wonderful doing a Riverside food tour is, but go on TripAdvisor, go on Google and read what past customers have said. And we're really proud of offering a VIP experience that we feel like is unmatched in Cincinnati.
In addition to the restaurants, does the tour benefit any local businesses outside of the food industry?
Well, of course, Findlay Market
visits
Cincy. You know, any of the new startup businesses, it really helps. You know, restaurants are hard business. That's a hard business to be in. And so we really try to seek out the new restaurants.
Oh, I love that.
Grow a lot of business their way. Just because, like I said before, it's a ripple effect of free advertising if you can just get people into the door. So, yeah. And you know what? When we go by hotels or we go by landmarks or pointing out architecture, even if we're not stepping inside your restaurant, we're sharing about all the breweries, all the different things to do. So, yes, you know, that was a good question. It does benefit a lot of businesses.
Do you like secretly... like, you know how like food critics try to sneak into restaurants to try them out and review? Do you like try to stealth sneak into restaurants to try and decide if like you're going to add them to?
Oh, yeah. 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 You know, that's another good question because people will say, why aren't you eating with us? Well, if I'm doing a tour 5 days a week,
that's a lot of food.
Eat not that much food. But on the flip side, before we even invite a restaurant to be a part of our business model, we do go in and we look at the menu and we try a couple dishes and we're thinking, all right, how could this stand out? How could this be a tie to Cincinnati? Then we'll go back and set up a meeting with the GM and say, you know, would you be interested and have a conversation from there?
Yeah. And it sounds like it's all local businesses. You're not going to any like national chains.
Mm-mm. No, no. And, you know, who wants to go to a national chain? You can do that at home, right?
Yeah. I mean, Grater's is probably, but it has its origins in Cincinnati. It's got like a strong tie to the community.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And when you come into a city, whether it's Cincinnati, whether it's Columbus, and there's so many choices, you don't know which restaurant to go to first. And so doing a food tour and then hanging out with a local for 3 hours, they can pick your brain and they can get very, targeted recommendations, like what's the best pasta place or what's the best burger place?
Yeah. You
know? So that's another advantage of hanging out with a local friendly guide for 3 hours.
One more time, Laura, what is your website? How do we book a tour?
you go to riversidefoodtours.com, and all the tours will appear on the screen. If you're looking for a specific date, go to the calendar and see what's offered.
That was Laura Noyes, owner and tour guide of Riverside Food Tours in Cincinnati and Covington. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Anne. It was a pleasure.
And thank you all for listening to All Sides, right here on 89.7 NPR News.